From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In President Bush's latest salvo on behalf of U.S. oil corporations in Iraq, he signed an executive order which provides U.S. oil companies total immunity for anything they do with Iraqi oil, from the point of production to the gas pump.
Operation Oily Immunity. But first, we'll speak with a former member of the Iraqi Reconstruction Council who explains why he resigned, saying, "I don't want to be a collaborator." Today, we'll talk about Liberia. Some 300 Nigerian troops are expected to land there today. Charles Taylor says he will relinquish power next week.
The U.S. relationship with Liberia is a long and sordid one. It dates back to 1816, when the first U.S. Navy warships delivered settlers, the first settlers, to Liberia. This was part of the American Colonization Society that was headed by then-President James Monroe, who then got to have his name attached to the capital of Liberia, Monrovia.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 46 Democratic senators have called on the Bush administration to declassify the 28 pages of the congressional 911 report that has been deleted from the public version. Senator Charles Schumer of New York said keeping this material classified only strengthens the theory that some in the U.S. government are hell-bent on covering up for the Saudis. The New York Times reports the classified portions of the 911 report indicate two Saudi citizens who had ties to a pair of hijackers were likely Saudi intelligence agents who may have reported directly to the Saudi government and received Saudi funding. The reports note that one of the Saudis, Omar al-Bayoumi, who claimed he was a student, had, quote, access to seemingly unlimited funding from Saudi Arabia. The report found he'd befriended two of the hijackers in San Diego, helped them find an apartment, and paid their first 2 months of rent. The classified report indicates Bayoumi started receiving more money from the Saudi government after he met the would-be hijackers. Al-Bayoumi is now living in Saudi Arabia and is expected to be questioned by U.S. officials. It's unclear why the U.S. has waited until now to question him thoroughly. He was only briefly questioned in Britain after the attacks. The other Saudi in the report is Osama Basnan, who did not know the hijackers but was a close associate of Bayoumi. The classified report states Al-Bayoumi traveled to Houston after the attacks when Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah was visiting President Bush. While Abdullah was meeting with Bush, Basnan was meeting with a Saudi official in Abdullah's entourage. Some 300 Nigerian troops are expected to land in Liberia today in the first wave of a West African peacekeeping force that could top 5,000 by month's end. The Washington Post reports Liberians are still pleading for President Bush to send in U.S. troops, but no move from Washington has been made. The deployment of U.S. troops has been delayed in part because President Bush first wants assurances that any troops that go into Liberia will be protected from prosecution from the International Criminal Court. Liberian President Charles Taylor had agreed to relinquish power on August 11th, but it's no longer clear when he will go into exile in Nigeria. Taylor wants the war crimes indictment against him to be dropped before he goes into exile. The Washington Post reports Secretary of State General Colin Powell, as well as his deputy, Richard Armitage, plan to step down in January 2005, even if President Bush wins the election. The unnamed sources, quote, say family commitments, not politics, are driving the decision. The Post reports Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice are among the top candidates to replace Powell. 50 people were killed in Chechnya near the Chechnya border after a truck bomb exploded outside a military hospital. Dozens more were wounded. No one has claimed responsibility for the blast. But the Russian news agency Interfax reports Chechen separatists led by Shamil Basayev were behind the attacks. A New Hampshire clergyman moved a step closer yesterday to becoming the first openly gay elected bishop in the Episcopal Church. The House of Deputies, a legislative body composed of clergy and lay people, voted to approve the Reverend V. Gene Robinson as Bishop of New York. The vote was one of two required to be confirmed. He faces a final vote today in the House of Bishops. 56-year-old Robinson is a divorced father of two and has lived with his partner, Mark Andrew, for 13 years. He was elected by his diocese in June, but the church requires a majority of convention delegates ratify his election. Robinson has rejected repeated calls from opponents to withdraw his candidacy to prevent a breakup of the church, as a gay clergyman in England did recently. Many say the decision threatens to divide the United States Church, which includes 2.3 million people, as well as the larger Anglican Communion, an association of 70 million people in churches in 164 countries. In 1998, during a once-a-decade meeting of top Anglican leaders from around the world, a majority supported a resolution that said homosexuality was, quote, incompatible with Scripture. But the resolution was not binding. Episcopalians on both sides of the issue say a final vote in favor of Robinson could build momentum for approving blessing ceremonies for same-sex couples. Israel has released the names of about 350 Palestinian prisoners it plans to release later this week. Israelis will be given a two-day period to review the list and can ask that certain Palestinians not be freed. Originally, news reports said Israel would release about 600 prisoners, but the number has been cut almost in half. All told, Israel's detaining about 6,000 Palestinians. This news from Iraq, the Guardian of London's reporting, over 800 U.S. soldiers have now been injured since the U.S. invaded Iraq in March. The total number of soldiers officially killed or wounded tops 1,000, but The Guardian estimates the total number of troops unofficially injured could be four or more times larger. Meanwhile, the Army has sent a team of medical experts to investigate an outbreak of pneumonia among U.S. troops that has left two dead and over 100 ill. Saddam Hussein's two sons, Uday and Qusay, were buried on Saturday, 11 days after they were killed by U.S. troops. The New York Times reports the funeral was attended by about 200 family members and friends. At the end of the ceremony, mourners began chanting, quote, "Our blood, our souls will sacrifice for Saddam, as well as death to America." And this news from Indonesia, U.S. freelance journalist Billy Nessen has been freed from the Indonesian jail after spending a month imprisoned. The journalist, who wrote regularly for the San Francisco Chronicle, was sentenced to time served. He was arrested after he spent months traveling with and reporting on the Achenese separatist movement. Nessen was arrested shortly after Indonesia launched a massive military attack on Aceh. I got it. Angelique Kidjou-Agolo here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. The British and U.S. governments are drawing up a controversial new strategy to convince the public that Saddam was developing weapons of mass destruction, admission they have so far failed to make a convincing case. The Big Impact Plan is designed to overwhelm and silence critics who have sought to put pressure on Tony Blair and George Bush. That's how the latest piece begins in The Independent of Andrew Buncombe. Blair and Bush join forces to spin away weapons issue. He joins us on the phone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you with us. Can you explain what this so-called Big Impact Plan is?
Well, I can and I can't. I mean, I can explain what the idea is. My concern is one thing I can't do is actually explain to you what they're going to put in it. The idea is quite simple. Officials here in Washington and in London feel that the Downing Street and the White House have failed to make the case about WMD, as I suspect most of us are fully aware. And they say that whilst they claim they have found certain evidence, it's come out piecemeal and bit by bit and hasn't had any impact. Now, I'm not so sure about that. I can think of one instance, perhaps, of something that was even vaguely looked like credible evidence to start off with. That's those two mobile laboratories, which I think everyone now concedes were for making helium. Anyway, the idea is that they'll gather whatever they have, they'll collate it, they'll put it together, and then later this year, perhaps as early as next month, they'll deliver this in one big go. I think something similar to what Colin Powell did before the UN on February the 5th it was, when he made his now notorious, infamous presentation. So that's the idea anyway. The idea is to put it all together, have it in one big go. Like I said, I mean, that does imply that they've got stuff to put in it, which I think would come as a surprise to many of us.
Can you talk about the role of the former UN weapons inspector, David Kaye?
That's right. I mean, Mr. Kaye, a former weapons inspector, went into private consulting for a company called SAIC, which did a lot of work for the CIA. He was appointed in June by George Tenet to head what is called the Iraq Survey Group. This is the group looking for evidence of weapons of mass destruction. That job was taken over from the Pentagon, basically because the administration here didn't feel that enough priority or importance was being attached to it. Now, it has to be said that since Mr. Kaye took over, as far as we know, the results have been no better. I mean, you'll recall back that during the build-up to the war, Rumsfeld and others were talking of hot sites and specific information about the locations of places they thought WMD were. Well, and the troops have been there now for 3 months and nothing's still been found. So whether or not this is going to be any different if Mr. Kaye stays longer, I'm not sure. He was in Washington last week giving evidence to a closed-door session of Congress. And when he came out afterwards, this was when he started telling reporters that I expect American people should not be surprised by surprises, whatever that's meant to mean.
You are listening to Democracy Now! We're speaking to Andrew Buncombe, who's written a piece in the British newspaper, The Independent, Blair and Bush join forces to spin away weapons issue. It's been very interesting to listen to the administration add the word program now every time they say weapons of mass destruction.
Absolutely. I mean, the language, any student of language would be fascinated by the way in which London and Washington have gone through somersaults over the last 18 months. As you point out, the most recent turn has been on the addition of program. I mean, I can remember sitting watching some Sunday morning talk show with Cheney on it, talking, I think it was probably Meet the Press, it usually is, talking quite clearly about Saddam's reconstituting his, not just his weapons, but his weapons, his nuclear weapons. Said that back in September, I think. Now it's changed to weapons program. Well, as Scott Ritter points out, we know that Iraq had a nuclear weapons program. That's been well detailed and well documented. The point he says is that it was also stopped, brought to a halt 1990s. Now, if Mr. K finds evidence of a weapons program dating from then, what's that going to tell us? Is that going to suddenly be spun as some justification?
Finally, being that you are from a newspaper in Britain, the latest on the David Kelly story.
Well, this seems to just go on and on, doesn't it? I mean,
David Kelly, of course, being the man that the British government said committed suicide, the weapons inspector who was the source for the BBC story on saying that the British government had exaggerated the threat of Saddam Hussein's arsenal.
That's right. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that the climate in Britain is extremely different to what it is in Washington here. People think that Bush has been getting a hard time. Well, he's been getting nothing like the time that Blair's had, and rightly so, I think most people would say. Kelly, this is, like you say, this was the source, we think, who used by the BBC to make it in one of its stories that the government had over-exaggerated claims of the threat from Iraq. Indeed, he took his life. A great deal of soul-searching since then. Tony Blair is likely to be called before a public inquiry into this. He's going to have to give evidence. His defense secretary, Jeff Hoon, is going to have to give evidence. His director of communications, Alistair Campbell, is likely to have to give evidence. Now, most people think that the last two names, Hoon and Campbell, basically are going to have to go as a result of this. Heads will roll. Blair, probably safe in his job, but who knows? If suddenly public turn against him and the party feels that he's no longer a benefit but actually a hindrance to them. Things happen very quickly in British politics, and we saw back in 1990 when Mrs. Thatcher went from being the heroine of the Conservatives to very quickly being dumped. Who knows, it could happen with Blair yet.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Andrew Buncombe of The Independent, the British newspaper. You are listening to Democracy Now! Speaking of Iraq, during the initial assault on Baghdad, soldiers set up forward bases named Camp Shell and Camp Exxon. Those soldiers knew the score, even if the Pentagon's talking points dismissed any ties between Iraqi oil and their blood. That's the beginning of a piece by Steve Kretzman and Jim Vallette that appeared on commondreams.org called Operation Oily Immunity. Jim Vallette of the Institute for Policy Studies joins us on the telephone right now. Can you talk about the Bush executive order that you've written about here?
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Can you talk about the executive order?
Sure. I mean, this is yet another Bush effort on behalf of U.S. corporations to seize control of Iraq's oil, and perhaps this is the most far-reaching. Back in May 22nd, the United Nations kind of bent into U.S. Demands to establish this development fund for Iraq and could sort of somewhat legitimize the U.S.-UK occupation of Iraq. This development fund was ostensibly designed to supply the humanitarian needs, meet the humanitarian needs of the Iraqi people, and in order to fund the development fund, it earmarks the revenues from sales of Iraqi oil to go directly into this oil fund. United Nations had a clause in there that provides immunity, legal immunity, for oil revenues from the sale of Iraqi oil to the point of sale. And that's designed to have a continuous flow of revenues from the sale of Iraqi oil into this development fund. But we've seen hours after the United Nations passed this resolution, Bush signed an executive order 13303, which goes much, much farther than the UN resolution on many, many counts. The Iraqi resolution halted the immunity to the point of sale. I mean, once the oil is sold, the revenues are there for the development fund's coffers. But Bush went so much further. He went to the whole lifetime of that oil. Once the title passes hands, it's still immune, as long as it's handled by U.S. corporations. So once it's on a tanker, once it's in the U.S. marketplace, once it's at the gas pump, it's still immune from any kind of accountability for anything that happens associated with the handling of that oil. And we've seen around the world what happens when corporations are extracting oil from the rest of the world, and in all the human rights disasters, ecological disasters that can occur.
You say in your piece, in other words, if ExxonMobil or Chevron Texaco touch Iraqi oil, it'll be immune from legal proceedings in the U.S. Anything that could go and elsewhere has gone awry with U.S. corporate oil operations will be immune to judgment. A massive tanker accident, an explosion in an oil refinery, the employment of slave labor to build a pipeline, murder of locals by corporate security, the release of billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Just some of the examples that you give.
Yeah, those are some of the things that we've seen routinely now, and what we've seen is the Bush-Cheney regime is more interested in protecting the ability of corporations to do these things, to extract oil, no matter what the consequences are for people on the ground or for the environment. The UN resolution, for example, had a clause that said ecological spills are not covered by this immunity. Well, he conveniently did not include that clause in the executive order. And very significantly, he also applied this executive order only to oil that's handled by U.S. corporations. That effectively cuts, you know, strips away any sort of similar immunity for other countries.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking to Jim Vallette, who is with the Institute for Policy Studies. IPS, what is your group calling for?
We're calling for the repeal of Executive Order 13303. It seems to have no basis in law or in morality.
For more information on the Executive Order 13303, you can go to www.scene.org. SCENE stands for Sustainable Energy and Economy Network of the Institute for Policy Studies. Jim Vallette, thanks for being with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with an Iraqi who returned to Iraq, became a part of the U.S.-appointed council, the Iraq Reconstruction Council, and then resigned. We'll find out why. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. A piece in The Guardian of London of July 28th begins, "On July 9th, with deep sorrow, I submitted my resignation as a member of the Iraqi Reconstruction and Development Council to U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz. I did this with great sadness, but in doing so, I was able to leave Iraq with a clear conscience. If I stayed any longer, I might not have been able to say that. I feared my role with the Reconstruction Council was sliding from what I had originally envisioned, working with allies in a democratic fashion, to collaborating with occupying forces. These are the words of Issam Al-Khafaji, a former member of the Iraq Reconstruction Council. He quit, wrote this piece in the paper, was a member of the Democratic Principles Working Group convened by the U.S. State Department to discuss the future of Iraqi governance. He joins us on the telephone right now from Amsterdam. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, hello.
Can you explain how you first got involved with this Iraqi Reconstruction Council and then what ultimately led you to resign?
I was contacted by members, by the coordinator of that council around February this year. And the idea was to form some kind of an apolitical council of experts or top experts whose mission was to rebuild the Iraqi state and bring it back to action.
And what were you doing? What was your profession?
Personally, I was supposed to be in the overseeing committee of, I wasn't assigned to a particular ministry, but the idea was to oversee the work of our teams, and we managed to form teams of four people for each ministry, and four people for each governorate, that's each province in Iraq outside Kurdistan, which is rather stable now. And that was the idea, that once we arrive to Iraq, we will proceed to involve Iraqis from within the ministries and the governors there to take over the jobs of bringing back basic services, bringing back the security, electricity, all these issues which Iraqis are still suffering from their lack. And that was it. We were supposed to have our job was supposed to be to take months, not a permanent council. I looked at it as an opportunity, and for me and for many other Iraqi Democrats who have been fighting against Saddam's regime, to go back to participate in rebuilding our country.
What was it like for you to return? When had you left Iraq originally?
I'm sorry?
When did you first left Iraq?
I left Iraq in 1978 after the campaigns of repression and forcing. I was teaching at the university then, and there were these attempts at ba'athifying, that's forcing each member of the faculties, etc., to join the ruling party of Saddam Hussein. But I entered clandestinely several times since then.
Doing what?
Doing a lot of things. I think now it's history. I mean, I never lost touch with my country. I never lost touch with the political currents, with the activities, against, democratic activities, if you like, against the regime of Saddam Hussein.
So what was it like to return a few weeks after?
Words cannot actually describe the emotional the emotions that overwhelmed all of us. Actually, it's a dream coming true. I can just say like that. And so many myths about the Iraqi diaspora, that we were out of touch, etc., have proven to be false. I mean, we fitted well immediately once we were there. Naturally, there would always be this sense of some kind of a distance, but I don't think that all these myths about Iraqis being out or dividing Iraqis into outside Iraqis and inside Iraqis from inside, I don't think that they are based on any reality.
So when you got there, when did you start to see that there was something wrong with the Reconstruction Council and how it was set up?
To tell you the truth, it was from day one that we discovered that our role as advisors was not wanted, actually. And nevertheless, we did our best to convince the coalition authority that it was in their best and in our best interest to involve us as advisors, as full partners in the job of rebuilding the state. But unfortunately, nothing of that materialized.
So explain what the situation was and what the role of the United States was in it.
The situation was like this, that I think that Iraqis in general and the council in particular, we were victims of this sweeping victory, of the U.S. sweeping victory. This is my analysis. It might not be accurate, but that actually the moment Saddam fell and the regime that is fell and the moment people met that with euphoria, the U.S. administration, it seems to me, or the occupation force, looked at it as a that there is no need for Iraqis, that things were going smoothly, that they could do it all by themselves. They appointed advisors, American, mostly American advisors, to run the ministries, to go to the ministries and check who would stay and who would leave. So Iraqis were actually either those who joined the teams, the American teams, were actually just relegated to a secondary jobs. And up till now, I can say that things are not moving in any other direction. And this explains to a large extent the paralysis of the Iraqi state, that nothing is moving, actually. And this is where the dangers are coming from, that Iraqis don't see any improvement in their life.
We just had a conversation with Jim Vallette talking about the Bush executive order that grants total immunity to U.S. oil companies that move into Iraq, Executive Order 13303. What is your response to that?
Well, my response is that it's also an unfortunate order, one to be added to the many unfortunate decisions that have been taken, because the one thing that Iraqis are suspicious about is that Americans have come here for oil. And once this reaches the public, the Iraqi public, this will only add to their fears that this is not an operation to build a democratic Iraq. This is not an operation to forge a new relationship between the Middle East and the West, or the Middle East and the United States. This is just an additional one more chapter in the sad history of the U.S. and the West looking at this region just like as a source of oil to plunder their oil in the cheapest possible way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I understand that you're going to be returning to Iraq.
I'm looking at various openings to go back to Iraq. Yes, I'm very enthusiastic about it.
In what capacity?
I'm looking at various different organizations, what they are offering me. The one thing that I would like to do is to feel that I'm doing an effective role in rebuilding my country. And I'm not looking for a political role. But I feel that I have some skills, if you like, that might benefit my country in the education, the cultural fields, and mostly in social issues. I'm looking at the different openings.
If you were President Bush right now, what would you be doing about Iraq?
First, I wouldn't like to be in President Bush's shoes, neither now nor at any other time. But I think the best thing is to go to Iraq, to go around and have some face-to-face talks with the people there, to see what their grievances are, what their solutions are, also not just to listen to their grievances, because the idea that we know the solution, we have the solutions for Iraq, has proven to be disastrous, and this is what has been going on for the past 4 months. There is an implicit idea that even if we listen to their grievances, it's us who give the solutions, and this is just bringing disastrous answers to deep crises. So I would say, Mr. President, go to Iraq, meet the people there, listen to their advice.
And Ahmed Chalabi, what has happened to him in the Iraq National Council that the U.S. has so firmly backed and brought back into Iraq, in many agencies suggesting he would be the new leader?
Well, he is not. I mean, now he is one of 25 members of a political council that's called the Governing Council. We'll have to wait and see what the authority of that council is. Once again, unfortunately, after weeks of establishing that council, Iraqis haven't seen any improvement in their life. They haven't seen this council taking real actions or approach to their problems. One indicator is that after weeks of deliberations, all they reached was a rotating presidency of among 9 members of the 25 presidency for 1 month. And this is just an indicator that the members are not being able to reach any consensus on any of the real issues facing Iraq and Iraqis. If they couldn't agree on a president, then how could they agree on the more important issues? Up till now, they haven't been able to form a cabinet or to appoint people to the ministries. I have the greatest respect for some of the members of that council. I have no doubt in their patriotism and their honesty and their commitment. But the problem is more than just looking at the individuals and their capacities. It's a structural problem, I should say.
Issam Al-Khafaji, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Again, a former member of the Iraqi Reconstruction Council who has resigned, saying, "I did not want to be a collaborator."
Thank you.
And thank you very much. Speaking to us from Amsterdam, you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move right now to Minneapolis, a New Hampshire clergyman has moved a step closer to becoming the first openly gay elected bishop of the Episcopal Church. The House of Deputies, a legislative body composed of clergy and lay people, voted to approve the Reverend Gene Robinson as Bishop of New Hampshire. The vote was one of two required to be confirmed. He faces a final vote today in the House of Bishops. Robinson is a divorced father of two, has lived with his partner, Mark Andrew, for 13 years. He was elected by his diocese in June, but the church requires that a majority of convention delegates ratify his election. Robinson has rejected repeated calls from opponents to withdraw his candidacy to prevent a breakup of the church, as a gay clergyman in Britain did recently. Many say the decision threatens to divide the U.S. church, which includes 2.3 million people, as well as the larger Anglican Communion, an association of 70 million people in churches in 164 countries. We go to Minneapolis now to Susan Russell, who's executive director of Claiming the Blessing Collaborative, which works with the Episcopal gay group Integrity. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thank you.
As we speak, the conference is going on. There is going to be a second vote on Reverend Gene Robinson to be the New Hampshire bishop. Can you talk about what's happened there this weekend and the significance of the vote yesterday in the House of Deputies to approve him?
The significance of that vote yesterday was amazing, not just the power of the Holy Spirit that we could feel in that hall, but the margin of the vote was greater, quite larger, in fact, than our numbers were telling us we could count on. And I'm convinced that the House of Bishops today will concur with his election, and New Hampshire is going to have a fabulous new bishop.
And what about this issue of whether the U.S. church will be divided, will actually separate into two?
Yes, Amy, one of the things to remember is that in 1976, the Episcopal Church met last in Minneapolis, and we approved the ordination of women. The same threats of schism and split were all in the air at that time. That was the last great schism that was going to split the church. It didn't split the Episcopal Church. It grew it. It made it stronger. It made it more vibrant. And I'm utterly convinced that when we take this next step forward on the inclusion of gay and lesbian people, we're going to look back at 2003 as another real watershed date for inclusion and the progressive gospel, the way we look at 1976 on the issue of women.
Reverend Susan Russell, what most struck you about this weekend? What will you remember?
Oh, my God. I will remember the power of the love that's been just palpable between the people in this place, people who've labored, some of us for, I've only been at this for a decade. Some of them have been at it 20 and 30 years, trying to move this church forward, not because we've got an agenda, but because we love the church and we love the gospel and we want to make this a church, a place where anybody is welcome. And the energy in the House of Deputies yesterday as we waited for that vote, sort of waiting for everybody to exhale. And also the quality and the tone and the timbre of the debate, even from those who, for whom this is not a good thing, has been, the tone has been high, the rhetoric has been respectful by and large, and I have great hope and excitement for what we'll do on the other side of this great move forward.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Reverend Susan Russell, Executive Director of Claiming the Blessing Collaborative.
Thanks, Amy.
To us from Minneapolis. Thank you very much. Where New Hampshire clergyman has gone through one of two votes, the House of Deputies, the legislative body of the Episcopal Church, has voted to make him the Bishop of New Hampshire. He will be the first openly gay bishop in the U.S. Episcopal Church. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about Liberia. Stay with us.
Buenas noches, queridos hermanos. Esta es la rumba del grupo Cuatro Estrellas. Y arriba.
You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Liberia, the first West African forces have arrived there today. 675 Nigerian soldiers, 18 of their officers, assembled on the airfield to take part in the first deployment. The troops are the start of a promised 3,250 force of UN peacekeepers. AP reported a dozen Nigerian soldiers in green camouflage and flak jackets leaping out of a Russian-made helicopter at Liberia's main airport. They took up defensive positions around the landing strip. Residents near Monrovia's embattled port heard cheers and watched flares go up as the rebels celebrated the arrival of the West African forces. The situation right now in Liberia is dire. People are suffering from disease, having been cut off by the fighting, as well as starvation. We turn now to David Goodman, who's a freelance reporter and author of Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. I spoke to him last week. He has reported on Liberia and the child soldiers, as well as the Firestone plant in Liberia, about the U.S. role over the years.
The U.S. relationship with Liberia is a long and sordid one. It dates back to 1816, when the first U.S. Navy warships delivered settlers, the first settlers, to Liberia. This was part of the American Colonization Society that was headed by then-President James Monroe, who then got to have his name attached to the capital of Liberia, Monrovia. Since that time, the operation then was sort of a bizarre mix of missionary zeal and ethnic cleansing. It was an attempt to have free African Americans leave the country because Southern slave owners were afraid of what they represented, that they might inspire slaves to revolt. And it was also the hope of a lot of missionary of churches that they could Christianize this African territory at that time. The relationship continued in the mid-1800s when officially Liberia was established by freed American slaves. But in the 1900s, it took on a much stronger economic dimension. In 1926, Harvey Firestone of Firestone Tires was granted a lease under strong pressure from the U.S. government, in which he had got 1 million acres of Liberia. Now, having traveled in the Firestone rubber plantation, this is the largest rubber plantation on earth. It supplies much of the rubber for Firestone tires, which until recently were the main tires on any Ford vehicle that you might have had. The plantation functions as almost a separate nation within Liberia. It has its own security force. It's basically a no-go zone for the Liberian government, and it gives very little back in terms of finances, except in the salaries it pays. When I was there in 1999, I was looking into the working conditions for Mother Jones magazine on the Firestone plantation, found out that rubber tappers there are paid $2.50 a day, and they were suffering as a result of the Firestone debacle here, where their tires were blowing up. So from making $2.50 a day, their wages were being further slashed and their benefits being further slashed in Liberia because of tires being blowing up on our roads.
We're talking to David Goodman, who has reported on Liberia, on the Firestone plant there and the Liberian workers, and also on child soldiers.
Right. I was also in Liberia for UNICEF, investigating the aftermath of the 7-year civil war that raged through the 1990s when Charles Taylor led a rebel group that eventually brought him to power in elections in 97. 15,000 children down to the age of 6 fought in that conflict. It became one of the most notorious conflicts for its use and abuse of children. I heard often in my travels around the country the particular fear that these units, they were called small boy units, the SBUs in Liberia. They were particularly feared because children can be persuaded and brainwashed to do just about anything. So many of the most heinous crimes during the Civil War were actually committed by children on the orders of their commanders. Once again now, in the conflict going on now, both the government and in Liberia and the rebel groups, LIRD and MODEL, have been accused of using child soldiers. I spent one particularly memorable day with a group of what were called hardcore combatants. These were children, by and large, the effort and if there's any effort at all made to do something for these kids, and often there is no effort made, but where help is offered, it's to reunite children with families. But these hardcore combatants had committed atrocities so severe that their communities would not take them back. Now, this is a kind of a longstanding ritual, which is that a way to prove loyalty to your commander is to force a child to do something to his own family or to his own community. The commander thus knowing that he cannot return to that community or family. So it can involve everything from burning down a whole village to killing a family to killing a family member. So these were the kids I were dealing with. And all I can tell you is that the damage done lasts a lifetime. And when I asked one Liberian social worker, looking around at the wreckage of Liberia, and it is particularly striking. I mean, I've traveled in war zones all throughout Africa. I've never seen anything quite like Liberia. The capital, Monrovia, it's as if a lawnmower were lowered over all the buildings. They're simply blown off. Glass lies shattered on the street that's been there for 7 years because no one bothers to clean it up. This was the state of Monrovia 2 years ago. One can only imagine right now.
What about Charles Taylor and the U.S. relationship with him?
Well, Charles Taylor, we have to trace him back just a couple more years to the coups that brought him into the picture. In 1980, there was a coup in which the President Tolbert was overthrown by a Sergeant Doe, a 28-year-old illiterate Army sergeant who had been trained by the U.S. Green Berets. Ronald Reagan, who was became president shortly after Doe came to power, Doe was a particularly sadistic leader, but he was also a particularly shrewd and loyal one when it came to the United States. At that time, in the 1980s, the U.S. was concerned that Libya was going to make a move in Africa and line up a series of satellite states. Doe played the Libya card very well, such that in the 1980s, Liberia became the top recipient of U.S. aid in sub-Saharan Africa, received over $400 million between 1981 and 1986. What flowed from that was an increasingly brutal dictatorship that enjoyed basically an open checkbook from Washington. As long as Doe kept uttering the words Libya or Russia, he was golden. He met with Ronald Reagan in a famous meeting where Ronald Reagan welcomed Chairman Mo to the White House instead of Samuel Doe. And Charles Taylor was actually a clerk in Doe's government, but then came to the United States, was arrested, and was going to be extradited.
Was arrested for what?
He was charged with corruption in Liberia, which is almost a joke since the corruption was endemic in Liberia with all this money flowing through. He was being extradited and was in jail outside of Boston, and miraculously escaped. It is thought that he had help from inside the prison, from the prison guards themselves. In 1989, he shows up in West Africa in Ivory Coast, launches an attack against Samuel Doe, and what follows is a horrendous 7-year-long civil war in which some 200,000 people are killed and 1.5 million people are displaced. That's where we are today. 1997, he gets elected president. I asked people around Liberia who they vote for. He won with 70% vote in an election that was actually certified to be somewhat free and fair. When I asked people, even educated Liberians, who'd you vote for? They said, well, we voted for Taylor. And why would you vote for a sadistic, warlord like this? And the answer was because he's the only one who can stop the fighting. If Taylor isn't president, the war goes on, and the soldiers go back to the bush. We know it will never end. What people voted for in 97 was an end to war. That meant voting for Charles Taylor. So, Taylor's corruption and brutality has not ceased, and so it's not surprising that he has also spawned conflicts in every state around him. Ivory Coast, the most stable country in West Africa, with a Liberian-backed insurgency now toppling the government. Guinea, Sierra Leone. So we have a ring.
Sierra Leone, he is doing it for the diamonds.
Right. How is he funding all this? So-called blood diamonds, which are the diamonds that are being extracted from Sierra Leone to finance his war, but also more recently timber sales. Charles Taylor, in a wide-ranging UN investigation, has been implicated in the sale of rare hardwoods. Is basically clear-cutting huge swatches of Liberia to sell these hardwoods overseas. So diamonds and wood has financed his war. But when you travel Liberia, again, you see the U.S. marks everywhere, enormous radio satellite towers that are here and there across the country. It was the main CIA listening post for all of Africa up until the Civil War in the 90s. So when we hear now that Liberians are looking to the United States, not to the French, not to the British, It's because they are intimately familiar with this close relationship with the U.S.
The second city has fallen to the rebels. Buchanan, you've spent time there.
Buchanan is, to call it a city by, I mean, it's has a ramp, kind of a wide open dirt road, path in the middle. I mean, it's been nearly destroyed in the last war. It was a base for Charles Taylor. And many of his old bases, his hometown in the interior, a place called Bonga, has fallen to the rebels. I mean, he's basically lost most of the country except for Monrovia. But Buchanan is significant. It's the second port city in Liberia. So to resupply or to feed the many people who are now starving in Liberia, it's either Buchanan or Monrovia. Now both ports have by and large been cut off because of fighting. So here we have, fast-forwarding to right now, we have Marines stationed off the coast of Liberia. Well, this is a very familiar scene for Liberians. In 1990, the first President Bush sent Marines to the coast of Liberia when fighting broke out. And a number of Liberians recounted to me the sense of joy at seeing that their suffering was about to end. The Americans had finally come. And indeed they came. And in a scene that was described to me, Marines landed in amphibious boats. Razor wire went up on the streets around the enormous U.S. embassy. The U.S. embassy takes over a whole section of the city called Mamba Point. And sure enough, the Marines came, got all the white people and embassy employees, and left. And what followed was the seven-year civil war. Interestingly, Bush's Undersecretary of State, this is Bush 1's Undersecretary of State for African Affairs, Herman Cohen, has said one of his biggest regrets in his exit interview was was dropping the ball in Liberia, in which he said, quote, a modest deployment could have avoided of our troops could have avoided a very long conflict. Well, what have we learned in the 13 years since that time? A modest deployment.
David Goodman, freelance journalist and author of the book Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa, has spent time reporting on and from Liberia. As we turn now in this last minute, we have just reached Alfonso Tawe, who is a Reuters correspondent in Monrovia. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us the latest situation there now, the reports of starvation and disease and the arrival of the Nigerian troops?
Yes, the latest information in Monrovia now is that about 40 Nigerian troops have arrived here and at the Roberts International Airport, where they've taken positions in various areas here. And the first thing they have done is to secure the entire area, the airport. And around here, too, as people are jubilating, people are happy that these troops have arrived here, and there's some sign of optimism for peace here.
And the situation in Monrovia to this point, we're reading of reports of starvation and disease.
Yes. There's an anxiety really here, and most of the people, almost everyone, is happy about what's happening here today. And there are thousands of people who have lined up from here to the airport, all standing out in anticipation to see these troops arrive in town.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Alfonso Tawe. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio cassette of this program, call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, where you can sign up for our daily digest, is www.democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Lenina Nadal, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Graffiti on your body, I am drawing.